la 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 la. That smile, it cracks your face, it cracks me up. It cracks down hard on my resistance to the love me in your eyes. And when you smile that lightning way you do away with grave by flashing bites of blue behind my cloudy skies. I know you're capable of glowing in the dark. And I know you're kissable for grinning up that spark. To warm the deepest part of me, to shine some sense on all I can be, to help my aspirations meet their mark with that smile.
Welcome to Queer Music Heritage, and this is J.D. Doyle. I'm heard every month as a part of Queer Voices on KPFT, and I open the show with Liza Minnelli and Billy Stritch doing a little bit of the song That Smile. And my regular listeners are probably already wondering why on earth I'm playing Liza Minnelli. They know that my policy is to only play GLBT artists, but this month I'm going to stray from that a few times, and with good reason. I'm focusing on the music of singer, songwriter, and composer John Facchino, and I've admired his music for many years. Of course, I'm not alone. His songs have been recorded and performed by a who's who of pop and cabaret artists. And John has also had a long association with Holly Near, playing for her in concert and on record. To grab a quick quote, Rex Reed said, "If Tennessee Williams was alive and writing tunes, he'd be John Facchino." In preparation for this show, I had a delightful 2.5-hour conversation with John, and he was very gracious in letting me dig deep into his career. There's a lot to cover, and this is one of those QMH shows where the story will continue on the internet version of the show. But let's get started. And John began writing music in the 70s, releasing his first records starting in 1980. He first recorded with Jimmy Haskell, and music buffs will recognize that name as the multiple Grammy and Emmy-winning producer and arranger of many of the top names in entertainment.
Tell me about your early 45s on Jimmy Haskell's label.
That, you know, I'd always dreamed of having a record deal, you know, and being supported in my writing and having a means to get it out into the world. And at the time I was living in Los Angeles, playing in a gay piano bar in Hollywood, and a psychic had come in, or a man who claimed he was a psychic, and he came in regularly and really liked my playing. I didn't play my own songs, but he said, "I'm going to get you a record deal." And I was like, "Yeah, right, of course." And son of a gun, he called me and said, "You have to come over right now. I have a man here who's starting a new record label." And the man was Jimmy Haskell. And he signed me on the spot. And then we recorded 4 sides and released 2 singles, which got a little tiny bit of airplay. But it was fun. I actually got to hear one of them on the radio, which is pretty exciting.
Which one?
It was a song called Something Is Simple. It was the second release. I was visiting friends in the Palm Springs area, which is where my family moved when I was 12, and had the radio on in the car, and it came on the radio. And, of course, I was screaming and really excited. But unfortunately, the label folded shortly thereafter, and nothing more happened with it. But, you know, I did get to experience recording and having things done with lots of musicians and a string section, and you know, it was amazing.
I actually have 3 45s. 2 of them are the same song on both sides.
Yeah. Oh my god.
So 3 different 45s.
Wow.
And one of them is Something Is Simple, and I think that is the best of the lot.
It's a sweet song.
And I think it wouldn't be a bad song to resurrect.
Oh, I don't know that it's. You know, the thing is, anything that I wrote with any sense of what I thought was pop seems a little bit dated. And strangely, the songs that I wrote that were just purely me, that you know, where I wasn't trying to connect with what was going on in the world musically or on radio musically, are kind of timeless, and they still work nowadays because they're just sort of, you know, idiosyncratic and not trying to be pop or trying to be anything. They just are what they are.
Lover's laugh can make a moment shine, and it warms the chill of a lonely half to know that you are mine. It seems that something as simple as sharing smiles when disagreement's melts the murder in the minds, and two can see as one. I feel with you that one and one make more than two. If you wanna see it through, you'll know I'll stay with you. Simple as holding hands while others drift apart is making it easy to understand the strength of a loving heart. Me right through with how much I care, how much I long to keep this time when something as simple as a lover's laugh can make a moment shine, and it warms the chill of a lonely half to know that you are mine, to know.
Something as Simple from 1981 by John Bacchino.
I know it's hard to be brief about this, but tell us about your association with Holly Near.
We started actually working together in 1984. We met through a fellow named Elliot Tilshaw, who recommended me, said that I should send them a tape at Redwood Records, which was Holly's record label. And all I knew, of course, at that point, I was looking for another record deal. And I sent a recording of a bunch of my songs, you know, thinking that they would be interested in me as a songwriter. Of course, they were a women's label, and they weren't really interested in men, especially at that time, recording for them. But Ronnie Gilbert, the woman who was in the group The Weavers, had started singing with Holly, and Ronnie was doing going to be doing a solo tour, and she was looking for a pianist. And she happened to come across my tape and liked my piano playing. And so she turned Holly on to me as well. And I ended up working with both of them. And Ronnie, as you noted in your email to me, was the first person to ever do a recording of one of my songs.
And you've appeared on many, many of Holly's albums.
Yeah. Well, we've worked together again since 1984, pretty much the whole time up till the last couple of years when I took a break to work on my Broadway show, which was kind of all-consuming.
Your first full-length recording came out in 1985. That was a cassette tape called On the Arrow.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about that release?
Sure. I had a band, and normally, I don't play well with others. I mean, I just think of myself as not playing well with others. I think it's because I pianistically kind of fill in all the spaces, so there's really not much room for other people to do anything, and I'm so particular about what I hear with my own song that it's just hard for me to let other musicians in. Back to On the Arrow, there was this band that I had put together, and we played in clubs in Los Angeles where I lived, and I thought it was time to do a recording, and so one by one, we went into little studios around L.A. as I could afford it, and just laid down these songs that I'd written.
That tape.
Do you have that,
yep.
By the way?
Yes, of course.
Wow. Of course. You're amazing.
That tape contains one of the shortest songs I know of. It's only 39 seconds.
Is that a Contact High?
Yeah. It's not at all typical of the rest of the recording, but it's irresistible.
That song, like so many songs that I write, is something that completely, pretty much word for word, happened to me. I think I had smoked pot for the first time, and I came home, and it was like 1 in the morning, and I remember being in the kitchen, and we had sliding doors to the backyard, and I opened the sliding door about halfway and then just sort of froze there, kind of in a dream state, just kind of my mind, of course, going a million miles an hour because I was really high, and my mom walked into the kitchen and said, "Are you all right?" And that's, I mean, I didn't exactly say what's in the song, but that experience is what prompted the silly little song.
So big deal, what if I did walk in at 3:30 a.m.? You act like I was some kind of a, hey, did you see those lights in the driveway? Never mind, no, I'm fine, it's just that, hey, did you hear a dog in the trash cans? It must be my imagination, now where was I? Oh, yeah, I think you need a drink, you should relax, you're too upset over a little thing like this. Yes, I wear my shades at night. Grounded? What do you mean? No, I don't smell anything odd. There was a lot of incense at that, hey, not my glasses. Yeah, they're a little bloodshot. On the way home, some dirt blew on my contact lens. All right, so some of the guys were smoking pot, but I was not. Have you ever known me to lie? Must have been a contact high.
A year after your first tape, other people started recording your songs, Ronnie Gilbert being the first. She did an album with Holly Near, and you participated in that called Singing With You, and
right.
Ronnie did in a restaurant by the sea.
She did, and it was so exciting. You know, I mean, to have somebody famous, not only, you know, was it somebody, you know, a singer recording a song of mine, but it was somebody who was famous. My gosh.
Here's Ronnie Gilbert from the 1986 album she recorded with Holly Near called Singing With You.
In a restaurant by the sea, on a liquid afternoon, for a moment eyes collide, and the world's periphery. Now your pupils learn the sun to reflect it brighter back. In a moment I'll come to and retrieve a sip of wine, but for now I drink you in. Inches separate our hands, when I move to close the gap. You reach out and meet halfway, while a wave defines the shore. For a moment eyes collide, and reality's the dream. With the wine wet on your lips and a tear moist in my eye, in a restaurant by the sea, on a liquid afternoon, for a moment
The funny thing is, though, I never really aspired to have other people singing my songs. I never really even thought of that. It wasn't really about that for me. I always wanted to be the singer-songwriter. You know, that was sort of my image all along. So while it was exciting to experience that, it was also made me a little uncomfortable. You know, and it still does. I have to say, I love when people record my songs, but the songs themselves are such personal things that it's a little weird. It's a little jarring for me, and especially since people have a tendency to want to mess with them. and that is, you know, it's sort of startling and sort of...
You're a little possessive.
Well, I'm a little possessive, yeah. I mean, it just throws me out of balance.
Also in 86, Elliot Pilshaw recorded two of your songs.
He
was the second one.
Yeah.
His album was called Feels Like Home, and you played for him and did the arrangements. And well, his album was where I first heard of you. And
wow.
His version of It Feels Like Home is still my favorite.
Can
you tell me about that song?
Yeah, I can. My very first partner, when we moved to New York, as I said, I got the record deal with Horn Records. But the next day, we were leaving for New York. So we moved here and actually lived here for about 8 months. One of the first times that I was alone in our little, you know, tiny apartment down in the East Village, the song just popped out. You know, I was waiting for him to come home, and it just felt very domestic and very sweet, and all as often happens with me, you know, the momentary feeling or experience can generate a whole song, and that's how the song happened.
I hear your key in the door unlocking, more than wood. The ceiling may not be dry yet, but it feels like home. Yes, we have come from a long way, friends say, wrong way. Still, I only know when you hold me, it feels like home. Need a dining room table. So far, there's no one to invite. For me, a cardboard box will do just fine, as long as I'm with you each night. It seems to me, if you never risk, you never. Since we're in this together, it feels like home. We don't need a dining room table. So far, there's no one to invite. For me, a cardboard box will do just fine, as long as I'm with you each night. Yes, we have come from a long way, friends say, wrong way. Still, I only know when you hold me, it feels like home. It feels like home. It feels like.
Interestingly, that song, It Feels Like Home, was also the first song that was performed in New York cabarets. Because when I wrote it, I was playing at a piano bar here in New York, and someone recommended a singer named Lois Sage to demo the song for me. And I met her, and she then began singing it, even after I left New York, because I only stayed for, I think, about 8 months, and then I moved back to L.A., she started singing it in cabarets, and that was sort of the introduction of New York cabaret audiences to my work.
I have two tapes of yours from the late 90s. I think they're essentially collections of demos by you and others. One is simply called 25 Songs by John Vecchino.
Wow, how did you, did I send you those?
I don't remember.
I very well
think so.
Yeah, probably.
I have also 26 songs by John Vecchino.
Well, there you go. I think you have more of my songs than my parents do. This is amazing.
My point was, that was probably the next step in you getting your music out there.
Well, you know, over my whole career, and friends, you know, kind of roll their eyes and laugh about this. Hopefully it's not annoying to people, but it's just this compulsion of mine. I love sharing my work. And in fact, I have the problem of when I, you know, do a CD, a professional CD, I give more of them away than I sell. And it gets expensive. Those 25, 26, you know, song CDs were my calling card for a while.
Another demo that showed up elsewhere on the wonderful 1995 compilation, A Love Worth Fighting For, is Sweet Dreams, and that also has gay content.
It does. And it's a story song. I was walking down Hollywood Boulevard, where, you know, they have the stars on the pavement, and a bus pulled up, and a young man and a young woman got off the bus. And that was really all. It was just seeing them with big backpacks getting off this bus in the middle of Hollywood Boulevard. And I don't know why things stimulate a song, but I went home and I made up a story about them. And that became the song Sweet Dream.
It's one of your most recorded songs.
A lot of people, Barbara Cook recorded it. And on my Grateful CD, I had the extreme joy of working with Judy Collins. And actually, something happened while we were in the studio recording that song, which is, I don't think it's never happened quite this way. We were recording it simultaneously. She was in a vocal isolation booth, and I was in the main room playing the piano, and I could see her through the glass. And as I was playing the song, about halfway through, I forgot that I was playing. I mean, this is the weirdest thing. My fingers just, it was like automatic playing, but I wasn't even thinking about it or aware of it. I was listening to Judy Collins sing my song, and I just got so wrapped up in her that I literally forgot I was playing. When it was over, I didn't remember having done it. And that's the take that's on the recording.
He left a man in New York City. She broke a home in New Orleans. They made their way to California. Sweet dreams, children. Sweet dreams, they hit it all. she kicked the cigarette machine and woke him apart from his nap beside it. Woke him apart from his sweet dreams. He talked about his sugar daddies. She talked about her mean marine. They settled down in seats adjoining, sharing sweet dreams, sweet dreams. Well, there's no man to sell your heart to when you're dancing across the TV screens. No husband to beat you when you're in the movies. Just sweet dreams, children, sweet dreams. Run away.
Judy Collins and Sweet Dreams. That's from a compilation you'll hear more about in just a few moments.
I would think that a composer would want to keep his songs fairly gender neutral so that the most people can record them. Is that something you think about?
I don't think about it for that reason. I think it's a policy that I sort of unconsciously adopted before I came out, so that I knew that I was singing the love songs to a man, but since there were no pronouns, nobody else would know that. And, you know, it's, of course, you know, internalized homophobia and, you know, whatever. You know, then it shifted over into the reason you mentioned, which is, well, it's also really handy to not really have specific pronouns so anybody can sing the songs. But initially it was just because I wasn't out. I didn't know how to be out. The world was a much less accepting place, and it was safer.
Have you written any clearly male-to-male songs?
Well, there's one about having a crush on a straight guy, but there's one verse about it, and it's called I've Learned to Let Things Go. There are no songs really where I, you know, sing, oh, I love him, I love him, I love him. No. But, you know, neither are there ones where I say, I love her, I love her, I love her. No, they're all just about sort of universal human feelings that transcend gender.
Mm-hmm.
Hi there, this is John Bucchino, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. And this is another one of my shows where I had much too much great material for just 1 hour. So you can find a much longer version of the show on my site. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Saturday night, Sunday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude.
You played on several of the tracks that ended up on Michael Callan's Legacy album.
Oh my God, yeah.
What was your relationship with Michael?
He was just one of the realest people I've ever met in my life. I adored him. I mean, he was an extraordinary human being, really powerful, really charismatic and passionate and committed to, of course, gay rights and AIDS education God, what an extraordinary fellow. So I was thrilled when he, first of all, he recorded a song of mine called Do Not Turn Away, which I had written when my brother was dying.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what inspired that song.
Yeah, well, my brother was dying. My mom, my brother had a partner for about 11 years, so he was a member of our family as well. My parents have always been completely supportive and wonderful. Both my brother, my sister, and I, are all gay. So it's sort of three out of three in our family. And my parents have been wonderful. My brother was still alive, and my mom had gone to an AIDS support group with his partner. And after this meeting, she called me in tears because she said that there was this beautiful 18-year-old boy who had got up and told the group that when he came out to his parents and told them that they knew he was gay and that he had AIDS, they kicked him out of the house and refused to have anything to do with it. And she was sobbing. I mean, it just broke her heart. She couldn't imagine how parents could do that, you know, to a child. And that's what prompted me to write the song. And then Michael gorgeously recorded it.
Oh, the saddest sound I ever heard was footsteps cold and sharp. They were speaking volumes of neglect as they faded in the dark. And the most haunting voice I ever felt was crying into space. A wounded angel trapped in flesh and wearing child's face, yes, wearing your child's face. Don't turn away, don't condemn, let your spirit comfort them. Peace awaits, but until then, and the price for burning bridges now is a lifetime of regret. How we love is no more choice than is the way we die. By you who gave them passage here, they must not be denied. Must not be denied. Don't turn away, don't condemn, let your spirit comfort them. Peace awaits, but until then, do not turn away. Don't turn away.
The year 2000 looks to be the year when huge progress was made in getting your music much more exposure, with the release of both the songbook and the CD called Grateful, the Songs of John Baquino. Tell us how those projects came about and were tied together.
Well, there was an acquaintance of mine named Bill Rosenfield who worked at RCA, and he had a bit of money set aside that he could do sort of a pet project with. I asked him if maybe I could record a CD, and he loved my work, but he was looking for a sort of an angle for it. You know, what's going to make people curious about this, or what's the hook here? So I thought about it, and I realized that over the 8 years that I had then lived in New York, I'd met quite a few famous people, famous singers, and that in fact many of them had already sung, performed, or recorded my songs. So I called them up, basically. I called up Liza Minnelli. I called up Art Garfunkel. I called up Judy Collins and Michael Feinstein and Patti LuPone and whatever. And I asked them if they would be willing to each sing a song on a compilation CD of my work. And God bless them, they all immediately said, of course, we're totally there for you. We would love to be a part of it. So I called Billy back and said, well, what do you think of this? I got commitments from, and then I listed all the fabulous people that had agreed to participate. And he was like, suddenly I'm very interested. You know, let's do this. And that's how it came about. And simultaneously, I just signed an administration publishing deal with the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization, and they wanted to put out a songbook, which made me both smile and grimace slightly, as I said, because it meant getting the songs on paper, and that was an uncomfortable prospect. I don't read or write music, but luckily the computer technology, it was just coming into existence that would enable me, and this is still the way I write things out, to play things in on two separate keyboards, the left hand on one keyboard, the right hand on another keyboard, into the computer, and then I email them to a friend of mine that I've worked with for now about 12 years, who just puts exactly what I play, so there's no guessing involved, into a print program. So anyway, the Rodgers and Hammerstein people wanted a songbook, and this album was coming together, and I had the idea, well, why don't we make the songbook and the album be the same song so that one can help sell the other? And that's exactly what we did and exactly what happened. And it got into the world. It went out into the world in a remarkable way that really did introduce me to cabaret singers especially, and then somewhat to musical theater performers all over the world.
This is probably the logical time to ask you about the title track, Grateful.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's sort of my greatest hit. And also, if I'm going to have a greatest hit, I'm really glad that it's a song that says what that song says. You know, it's not just some silly little novelty song. It's something that I really believe in. It's something that expresses a sentiment that's really important to me. The way the song happened, I was cleaning a house on a Saturday, and all of a sudden found myself sitting at the piano singing the chorus of Grateful. I mean, kind of full-blown. It just kind of happened. It's not that complicated of a chorus, but I just started singing it and weeping and thinking, what is this? This is important. And then for probably the next 2 months, I would, you know, go to the piano and sit, play the chorus, and cry. But it was so perfect and so simple and so inspired that, you know, I couldn't bring myself to try to write anything else, because I thought, well, it can't possibly be as good, and it's not going to come from the same place. But eventually, I forced myself. It was another Saturday afternoon. I forced myself to write the rest of the song, which at the time felt really kind of cobbled together and And that evening I was going to be having dinner with Art Garfunkel, who had become a friend of mine. And I said, instead of meeting at the restaurant, can you come over here? Because I just finished a song and I think it's kind of good. And he came over and leaned on the piano and listened to it. And I played it for him. He was the first person to hear it. And he said, don't give that to anyone. It's mine. Which is always what you want to hear Art Garfunkel say when he listens to your song. And 2 weeks later, he had it in his show, and he toured Europe and closed his show with it and then recorded it. And since, my God, that is by far the most recorded song that I've ever written.
I've got a roof over my head. I've got a warm place to sleep. Some nights I lie awake counting gifts instead of counting sheep. I've got a heart that can hold love. I've got a mind that can think. There may be times when I lose the light and let my spirit sink, but I can't stay depressed when I remember how I'm blessed. Grateful, grateful, truly grateful I am. Grateful, grateful, truly blessed and duly grateful. In a city of strangers, I've got a family of friends. No matter what rocks and brambles fill the way, I know that they will stay until the end. I feel a hand holding my hand. It's not a hand you can see. But on the road to the promised land, and will shepherd me through delight and despair, holding tight and always there. Grateful, grateful, truly grateful I am. Grateful, dream of more, but giving thanks for what I've got makes me so much happier than keeping score. In a world that can bring pain, I will still take each chance, for I believe that whatever the terrain, our feet to dance, whatever stone life may sling, we can moan or we can sing. Grateful, grateful, truly grateful I am. Grateful, grateful, truly. Thank you.
Grateful by Art Garfunkel.
In 2006, you released on CD another important showcase of your work, It's Only Life.
Yes. For years, since I moved to New York, and actually even before I moved to New York, people, and, you know, God bless them, it's great, different people wanted to put together a review, musical review of my songs. And I was always open to it, and I worked with several, three different people that I can think of, and other people had tried to do it on their own, to try to come up with a musical review that would work. And the review is a very tricky form because you can't really tell a story with songs that weren't written to tell that story. That's really difficult. So what Daisy Prince, who directed and put it together with me, her feeling about it was to put songs together to convey an emotional arc. And it's been sort of the loosest construction, in a way, of any of the attempts at doing a review. And yet, the best, I think, the most emotionally fulfilling, there really is an emotional progression to the songs in the show. And that is profound and sort of metaphysical and sort of uplifting. And that's, you know, what I always want my music to do anyway. So the fact that Daisy managed to structure this in a way that achieves that without a story and without characters is miraculous to me. She's just brilliant.
From that project, so that you could hear the entire cast, is the title track, It's Only Life.
It's only life, it's not that big a deal. A skin we shed, and once we're dead, it doesn't matter what somebody did or didn't feel. It's only time, and time is very small. A bill we're sold, but truth be told, we really need it mostly not at all.
Soar is what we can fall.
Stop a heart. A heart is strong, it beats along, in many cases smarter than an Einstein mind is smart.
It's only props, no reason to be proud. A purely chance, atomic dance, and every bit as solid as a cloud.
Free is what we know, bound is when we fear. Logic is a training wheels. Home is what we are. Lost is when we run. Rhyme is what it doesn't have to do unless we want it to. It's a lot more straightforward than karma or luck when we feel like we're hopelessly stuck. Stuck, stuck, stuck is what we learn. Flow is when we trust. Memory is the lock or it's the key. Hope is what we breathe. Dark is when we're blind. Rhyme is what it doesn't have to do unless we want it to. It's only life, it's not that big a deal.
It's only life.
We're running out of time for this first hour, but there's so much more to tell about the career of John Bacchino. like his work with Romanowski and Phillips, and his friendship with composer Stephen Schwartz, and how, without John, Stephen may have never created his hit musical, Wicked. And then we'll hear about John's music in the DreamWorks movie, Joseph King of Dreams, and of course, the Broadway musical, A Catered Affair with Harvey Fierstein, and much, much more music. Oh yeah, we'll also talk about John's instrumental album called On Richard Rogers' Piano, from which you've been hearing excerpts under the interview segments. I want to thank you all for listening, and I especially want to thank John Bacchino for the wonderful interview. Again, there's more to the story at my site at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. And of course, I hope you'll want to find out more about John Bacchino. And for that, please visit his website at www.johnbacchino.com. And Bacchino is spelled B-U-C-C-H-I-N-O. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. I'm closing with one more song from the compilation from 2000 called Grateful, the Songs of John Bacchino.
On the Grateful compilation is another artist I like very much, Brian Lane Green.
Yeah.
I remember in 1996 writing a very gushing review of his debut album, which you produced.
Yes, I did. I did.
And he did a stunning version of Grateful, but also on your compilation is the song Taking the Wheel.
Yeah.
It's another one many people have recorded. Could you talk about Taking the Wheel?
Sure. It's an old one. I mean, it's probably 25 years old. That's the interesting thing I said earlier on, that the songs that I write just from my experience that aren't connected to any particular musical style or, you know, popular style are really still valuable and don't feel dated at all, and that's one of them. But I think I probably wrote it in 1978 or something. I don't know exactly when, but it's a really old song. And I think that I was in a period where I was grappling with career sort of paralysis, or, you know, nothing was going on. I couldn't get people to listen to my songs. Nobody was interested because I wasn't writing things that sounded like they were on the radio. And that song, I think, was an assertion. The lyrics, you know, are very strong and very forward moving. And I think that was just an assertion of me talking to myself, giving myself a pep talk and sort of acting as if I was moving forward when I really didn't feel like I was. So I think that's why people may respond to it, is because it's the kind of pep talk that, you know, we all give ourselves periodically.
Brian Lane Green and Taking the Wheel.
It's no good. It's too pat. I can't just play a final song, say so long, and leave it at that. It's all right, I've got time. So I didn't hitch a ride on a rocket to the top, I'll get there in a steady climb. What did it mean? What have I learned? Crossing bridges before they're burned, leading life instead of being led. Using my head, what's it about? Did I lose innocence going in or gain experience coming out? What did it mean? What have I learned? Off tables before they turned, living life instead of playing dead. Throwing down the pencil and grabbing a pen, taking the wheel, driving again. Throwing down the pencil and writing in ink, this is how I feel, this is what I think. Dreaming again and making those dreams real. No big deal, I'll hit my stride. If I'm not breaking the ribbon at the end of the race, it's only 'cause I haven't tried. What did it mean? What have I learned? Taking the credit I know I've earned. Waking up and flying out of bed. Throwing down the pencil and grabbing a pen. Taking the wheel, driving again. Throwing down the pencil and writing in ink. This is how I feel. This is what I think. Dreaming again and making those dreams real. Taking the wheel. I've been
front seat long enough, tagging along for the ride. I've been in the back seat long enough to know that you never get what you deserve if you never can decide. There's only one way to get where you wanna go. Throwing down the pencil and grabbing a pen, taking the wheel, driving again. Throwing down the pencil and writing in ink, this is how I feel, this is what I think. Dreaming again and making those dreams real, taking the wheel. Making those dreams so.